Just like a woman.
My guest on the first time this week is an American artist. She started work as part of the downtown art scene of her beloved New York in the 70s and became a pioneer of performance and installation art, embracing the creative possibilities of multimedia and technology in a way that few people have ever done, either in the avant-garde or the mainstream. She's also a poet, photographer, author, art historian, illustrator, filmmaker, composer, lyricist and singer. And it's the last three things that we're going to focus on in this show. An hour simply isn't enough time to fit in all the things that she's done. But I'm very, very happy to welcome to the first time this week, Laurie Anderson. For a long time, Laurie has been one of the most interesting and brilliant figures in experimental art. All her work has a sense of inquisitiveness, daring, humanity and humour, something you might not normally associate with the art world. In one of her most famous pieces, Duets on Ice, she wore ice skates frozen in blocks of ice and played a duet with herself on a specially designed violin. She replaced the bow hair with pre-recorded audio tape and the strings with a tape head, and she performed until the ice melted. She created a full symphony for car horns, an electronic bodysuit that allowed her to create rhythms by hitting different parts of her body, and she was the first and last artist in residence at NASA. She even entered the mainstream pop world in 1981 with a hit single, Oh Superman, and Big Science, the album that followed, which is about to get a vinyl release for the first time in 30 years. But there was music before then, and a lot of music since, all of it fascinating. Which is what this show is about, the music of her childhood in Illinois, the earliest recordings she made for art galleries and tiny record labels in the 70s, and the inspiration behind Oh Superman. We also talk about the musicians that she loves, like Lou Reed, Philip Glass, Brian Eno, Brian Wilson, and Arvo Pärt. It's a very different kind of first time this week, but I still started by asking Laurie, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time she was aware of music?
Well, let's see, probably when we were kids, we had roller skating music, and we used Chubby Checker to roller skate to. And we had a playroom and some pretty, probably pretty terrible speakers, but we played it really loud. And there was a giant map of the world, a floor-to-ceiling map of the world. And we cranked up Chubby Checker and skated around the room and dreamed about what it would be like to go anywhere but the Midwest in Illinois.
Do the pony with your partner, or in a big boss line. But anyway you do it, you're gonna look real fine. So get with it, well, don't quit it. Get up! Now you turn to the left, when I say G. You turn to the right, when I say hard, now G. Jam, jam, little baby, now hard. Jam, oh baby, oh baby. Pony baby, do it baby. Oh baby, oh baby. Gonna see little Susie, who lives next door. She's doing the pony, she's taking the floor.
So was music kind of a sort of door into a wider world for you then?
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. But a lot of things were, you know, puppet shows were, books were, especially books, I have to say, were the doors.
Outside of the playroom, was the rest of your childhood home kind of a place that was filled with music? What kind of music was around you when you were young?
Lots. There was, we had a family orchestra. So,
family orchestra, wow.
Well, there were 10 of us, you know. It's like 8 kids and a couple parents, and that left only one person in the audience. It was my dad. And he had to listen to this stuff, you know. So we were like, yeah, we had woodwinds and we had drums, strings, no vocals, but, you know, it sounded really terrible, I'm sure, but it was so much fun to do. And, you know, and my father was very, very appreciative.
What kind of thing would you play as an orchestra? What kind of pieces would you learn?
We made it up.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was an improv orchestra.
Already improvising. That's brilliant.
Well, you know, we're all in the orchestras and bands for kids in school, but we didn't have any of the music for that. So we would just play our idea of what violin should sound like.
I love that. That's kind of beautiful. There's a sweetness and a sort of an honesty to that, you know? It's beautiful.
You didn't have to sit there. Because sometimes you don't know if the music is terrible. And I have an example of that is I got an instrument that was a hurdy-gurdy. Mm. And they're kind of weirdly difficult to play. And I was playing it once and cranking away and doing stuff. And I was looking out the studio and 3 people were at different distances. So I was looking at the 3 different faces. We're not seeing each other. The first one had a look of pain on his face. The second was just absolute boredom. Like, is this ever going to end? And I was looking up at them thinking, is this so great? It sounds so great. And the other one was just disgust. So, you know, you never know what other people like. Thank you.
Another first. What was the first record that you owned that was yours, that you possessed?
It was a very weird one, and it was a 45 called Letters from Daddy, and it was what we would now call a spoken word record, okay. Which sounds like, you know, which is one of the worst names for any kind of art form ever. You know, do they call novels written word art? No, they do not. You know, so spoken word art. Anyway, this guy was probably, this was from World War II, I guess, a record that was made somehow back then and that I got hold of. I don't know, in an old record store or something, I guess. Not from me, because I was 5 years old. I didn't go to new record stores or old record stores. I went, you know, probably a relative gave this to me. I loved this record because it was a guy being shot at. There was explosions in the background. You know, stuff like that. Yeah, and he's hunched down in some trench somewhere. And he's writing to his kid. And it wasn't clear whether it was a boy or a girl, but I definitely wanted to be his kid. And he was just saying, don't worry, I'm going to come back. I'm gonna do this. I'm going to come back.
It sounds heart-wrenching.
It was really nice. And you know what? One of my uncles, fighting in France in the trenches, did come back. And this is another sound memory that I have of, it was the biggest sound of my childhood. And he got what we now call PTSD, what they call shell shock then. Mm. And he was sent back home to Chicago.
Yeah.
After fighting the Nazis. And he was crazy. And he was sent to live with us. And he lived in the attic for like 3 years. And he screamed for 3 years. Every night, I just remember this guy up there, terrified. And then you know what happened after that? You know, Uncle Alan, he got slowly better. And then he came out of the attic. And then he met a girl. And he got married. And then he had a life.
Yeah.
Then you were expected to take care of these guys.
Jeez.
Yeah. For a while, it was scary, and then it just became, you know, kind of comforting. There's Al up in the, Uncle Al up in the attic going crazy, and you get used to it, and then if it stops, it's like a problem, you know?
One of the songs on your list, Mr. Big Stuff by Gene Knight. Oh. Tell me about that song, because it's a wonderful tune. Why was that on your list then?
Just, it's got a great, great groove. And also, the first time I heard that, I was doing like art performances. And a lot of the music in those art performances, they were film performances. And I would shoot these films and then show them in film festivals. And by film festival, I mean like eight people in a loft in New York, downtown New York, looking at each other's movies. So I would never finish in time the film. So I would stand in front of the movie and play the violin. And they were tended to be a little bit lugubrious sort of songs because I had to talk over them. So you can't have a long story with much of a beat. You know, it's just not, doesn't work so well. Then I heard this Mr. Big Stuff and I thought, okay, I'm going to do a part of this movie is going to be like that's going to be the soundtrack. So I cut it up in a lot of different ways and used it like a mashup thing. It sounded so great, you know, you can just hear 4 seconds of that thing and you're dancing.
It's the big stuff. Who do you think you are? It's the big stuff. You're never gonna get my love. Now because you wear all those fancy clothes. Oh, yeah. And have a big fine car. Oh, yes, you do now. Every star above me.
Another important first for you, the first trip to New York, the first time you went, what are the images that come into your mind? And what are the sounds that come into your mind about the first time you went there?
Wow. Well, I was maybe 9 years old.
Yeah.
And the first thing that came to mind was water, because I was from the landlocked place, and it was the first time I'd been in a port. Except for, well, Chicago's a little bit of a port, but it's the Great Lakes, and they're not the mighty Atlantic. So I saw this city, and it was wild. First of all, there were so many ships, different kinds of ships going around, you know, like big freighters and ocean liners and, you know, just, oh, my, yeah. The sounds were incredible. There was tons of tugboats. And I also remember tons of people hanging out their windows, and it was like a gabby city. It was like so boisterous and wild, you know. I thought, wow, it's a street city, and I just thought, I want to go where people are out in the street and misbehaving, you know. Just and now that I'm here in New York during the pandemic, it's like a little bit like that, because all the tourists are gone. Now, and who's left? New Yorkers. Who are they? Weirdos. We're all the weirdos, and I knew that weirdos went to New York. That's why I wanted to go.
It's interesting, yeah, that your first sort of sound memories of New York were like the huge, vast sound of these ships, but also just conversation, which is obviously, you know, that's formed so much of your work. Those conversations, that New York social life thing. It's interesting.
Yeah, people. You know, I'm just in my work is about that.
Yeah.
For being a loner, it's very social work.
I live by the Hudson River, and a lot of boats go by. They glide by so quickly, camouflaged against the Jersey shore. Sometimes at night when the liners are lit up, it's hard to tell which is moving, the boat or the shoreline. And it seems like all of Manhattan has come unanchored and is slowly drifting out to sea.
Another song on the list is by Brian Wilson. And this is really interesting, because I obviously love Brian Wilson and
yeah.
I love his work. And you've chosen a demo of a song that would become a song called Little Children, but it's called They're Marching Along. And it's the strangest piece of Brian Wilson music I think I've ever heard, but it's beautiful. How did this song come into your orbit?
You know, Dr. Landy, who used to work with Brian Wilson, asked me to come out to work with Brian on a song to his studio. And so I went out there, and I loved the Beach Boys. So I was like, yeah, and I love it. So I sat around with Brian in his studio, which was on the water. And when I say on the water, if you opened up the glass doors, the tide would be in your room.
Oh, how beautiful.
It was not on the beach. It was
the beach.
It was the beach. It was the beach boy on the beach. And it was like, he had this most clunky sounding piano, teeny sounding piano, and so Dr. Landy said, "Well, you know, he's working on a song about kids and kids going to school," and I was like, "Oh, I love kids going to school. I love what their faces look like." And so what I was trying to get some lines into the song about kids who, you know, when they sometimes have to rush to the bus, mm-hmm. They are still all like wrinkled up from their pillows. They look like little old people, like just like, you know, I said, "Can we get that idea into the song?" And Brian was, "No, I don't think that fits it. They're marching." You know, I was like, "I know they're marching, but they're like, they're tired." You know, and so anyway, he's playing that over and over, that theme song, and I'm just trying to get the words in. So that's why I picked that song. It's one of my favorite songs because it was not something that I got to be part of, but that's okay.
On a Monday morning, you see a little band.
As this is firsts, and we're talking about your music career, was your first, technically your first single, was it "It's Not the Bullet That Kills You, It's the Hole"? Was that, is that right?
Single. Well, you know, no.
There you go. All my brilliant research is thrown out of the window. No,
It was very close because I put out a bunch of singles in that group of things because it was something that I made for a jukebox.
Yeah.
But the one that I put out before that, which what you'd call, I guess, a single at that point, was called "Time to Go." And that came out a little bit before that one, but not by much. "Time to Go" was about a guard at the Museum of Modern Art who was, his job was go around at the end of the day and snap people out of their art trances. So he would just go around and go, "Time to go." He'd jump in front of them, he'd snap his fingers, boop. Time to go. Anyway, his name was Diego, so it's called "Time to Go" for Diego.
People who'd been standing in front of one thing for hours. He would jump in front of them and snap his fingers. And he'd say, "Time to go. Time to go. Time to go."
I was listening to some of the early stuff, and there's "Is Anybody Home?" I was fascinated by because it's a song that talks about the song that the protagonist is writing, and in fact part of the song is the creation of the song that the protagonist is talking about.
Now there's pure songwriting for you.
Exactly. It's just, yeah, there's such, I mean,
how did you find that song?
It's the BBC, we can find this stuff.
Okay.
It's a kind of rhythm, a kind of sinking that's been getting into the songs I've been writing lately. Like walking upstairs in the dark, and you think there's one more step than there actually is, and your foot comes pounding down with nothing underneath. Or like the piano we got a few months ago. Only a few keys work, so we put it out in the hall near the door. And when people come in, they rake their hands across the keyboard, playing the few notes that still work. It's kind of a doorbell now. All the sounds around.
There's so much joy. There's so much joy and pleasure in the lyricism of a lot of that stuff, isn't there?
You know, I haven't heard that for decades. And
really? Oh, it's brilliant.
Yeah, because I don't even know if I have it anymore anywhere. I'm not that good at my archive. You know? So, yeah.
With "It's Not the Bullet," that's like, musically it's so playful and it's beautiful and kind of intricate, but lyrically we're kind of we're sort of grinning and grimacing at the same time with that particular piece of music, which is just a wonderful song.
Well, you know, that was written for Chris Burden, and he was an artist who shot himself. And every time I talked to Chris, he would go on and on about, like, the caliber of the bullet and what the kind of gun was like. And it was really, like, boy-guy stuff about bullets and guns. And I was like, Chris, you know, it's not the bullet that kills you. It's the hull. So, you know, if you want to talk about shooting yourself, go beyond the caliber.
It's Not the Bullet That Kills You, It's the Hole, by my guest here on The First Time This Week, Laurie Anderson. That was a song recorded in 1976 for an art installation at the Holly Solomon Gallery in New York. That consisted of a jukebox which played singles especially recorded by Laurie. And we'll have more from my conversation with Laurie covering, amongst other things, the creation of her famous single, Oh Superman, all coming up after the Six Music News.
Six Music.
This is BBC Radio.
Six Music.
BBC News at 1:30. I'm Adam Porter. Ministers say they're waiting for the Metropolitan Police to explain their actions after clashes with women during a vigil for Sarah Everard in South London last night. The Liberal Democrats have called for the Met Police Commissioner, Dame Cressida Dick, to resign. Grace Jessop is from Reclaim These Streets, which cancelled its vigil.
They have failed to work with us. They have created the dangerous and unsafe situation that occurred last night. And actually, this just goes to show that the police and the government, in fact, need to listen and realise that the criminal justice system is failing women time and time again. And this is an example of that.
The Republic of Ireland has suspended the use of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine because of reports from Norway that four adults developed blood clots after receiving the jab. The UK regulator, the MHRA, said the available evidence didn't suggest the vaccine caused the clots. The head of the Office for National Statistics has said he has no doubt there'll be a further wave of COVID infections in the autumn. Professor Sir Ian Diamond said the vaccine rollout had been incredibly impressive, but he said it was important to keep track of the data as it changed.
We need to be really looking at the impact of the wonderful vaccination rollout that we are seeing. But having said that, we need also to recognise that this is a virus that isn't going to go away. And I have no doubt that in the autumn there will be a further wave of infections.
The Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has described Iran's treatment of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe as cruel and inhumane. She's appeared in court on new charges just a week after a five-year sentence came to an end. The Ministry of Defence has promised that the army will get an upgraded, digitised and networked armoured force after the current state of its tanks was criticised by MPs. The Commons Defence Committee said the UK was likely to be outgunned in any future conflict. That's 6 Music News. The next updates at 2:30.
BBC Radio 6 Music. Now on BBC Sounds.
6 Music.
Welcome back to the first time here on 6 Music with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Laurie Anderson. The music you were listening to then was the first part of Philip Glass's Music in 12 Parts, written between 1971 and 1974. Laurie and Philip met in the early 70s in Manhattan, starting a creative and collaborative relationship and friendship that continues to the present day. Another piece of music on your list is by Philip Glass, Music in 12 Parts, which is just beautiful.
It is.
Staggeringly beautiful. Is it right that you went to the rehearsals before it was performed in public? Is that right?
We all did. Yeah, that's what we did.
Oh, wow.
And this is the entire New York art world, which was about 12 people, so, at that time. And, yeah, I remember going there, and especially what Saul LeWitt would say. He'd say, I do my best work at Phil's rehearsals. Because you just lie there for 8 hours comatose on the floor and stare at the ceiling and listen to this music, and it does something to your brain waves, you know, it just does. And I love music that is not pushing you in that way, it's freeing you through its monotony, you know, and through its beautiful being in the present. There's not going to be a recurring melody here, not really, or there's going to be like a lot of stretched out other things. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, melody's the end all of anything, but your expectations change when you listen to that music.
When it comes to making music, how much do you enjoy the kind of nuts and bolts, the kind of technical stuff? I know you've talked about being in New York and going to junk stores and taking things apart and them not working and then using them for other things. Does the physical, the wheels and the cogs or the buttons, does that fascinate you? Or what's your relationship like with the technical side of making music? Is that part of the creation for you?
Well, that's a good point, because there aren't any buttons anymore and there aren't any gears.
Yeah.
There are no gears.
This is true.
Yeah.
I miss the gears.
Me too. There's just
I miss handles.
I know, handles, gears, little tick-tocking things. Nothing talks or ticks or moves around. There's no moving parts. It's just black boxes. You don't really know what's inside them. And so to fix them is really a different kind of exercise completely that I do not have the skill to do. So anyway, I used to tinker a lot, but I've been cleaning out the studio here, and I did find a lot of old gear. So I'm kind of thinking maybe I would do something with it.
Yeah, there was, and this is a quote from you talking about analog equipment, and you said, forgive me if I get it slightly wrong, if you erase an audio tape, there's little molecules of sound desperately clinging to the tape. But if you tell a computer to forget something, you can't get it back. It's gone forever. Do you like that older way of recording stuff? Does that still appeal to you? Or is it now just, it's just tools? It doesn't matter.
First of all, it's not gone forever. It's probably lurking around in some other form up in the cloud, you know?
Okay, that's a good point.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to erase stuff, even now. So I'm very intrigued by that. You know, it's a really interesting thing to try to make another world. When you try to do that digitally, it's a whole other thing. You know, so when we do it in VR, we actually have to manufacture atmosphere and air by putting the tiniest little bits in the what would be air, what represented air, let's say, so that otherwise you're in a vacuum. You know, in the same vacuum that you are if you make a drawing and there's nothing there except the line. It's a, you know, when you try to represent space, it's not just the things in it. It's what gives it distance and what gives it luminance and what gives it atmosphere is some sense of air. So it's same with in digital recording. It's a big thing to try to put air and room into a recording that's just my box to your box. It never even pumped any air. It just was right into the earbuds. So there's something very, very unreal about that.
Yeah.
Eerily unreal. It was never in a room. It's like a piece of gold that was never touched. It's just something that is very immaterial.
Another song on your list is Au Souverain by Massenet, which is connected to a song that you are connected to, obviously. Can you tell me the story of this piece of music and how it relates to you, if you would be so kind?
Oh, I would be so kind, yes. I am so kind. I try to be kind. Anyway, Charles Holland was a really wonderful tenor, opera singer, American, who never got a chance to sing any significant roles in the U.S. because opera and not only opera, but the whole country is very deeply racist and just doesn't give, and certainly didn't in 40 years ago when this was, when Charles left the United States, didn't give black artists much of a shake, you know. So he said, enough with this, I'm going to Holland. I heard a concert that he did, it was just solo thing, with the conductor Dennis Russell Davies playing piano, and he sang a song from Le Cid, a Massenet thing called Au Souverain, and it is a prayer. It was a prayer that he was singing, and it started off, Au Souverain, au juge, au père. It was a, you know, request for help. It was a prayer. It wasn't like a kind of prayer of veneration. It was a prayer of desperation. And so Charles sang that so beautifully in this chilling way, and I felt a real rapport with him because I was an expat too then. I wasn't working that much in the U.S. There wasn't much of a scene. And the scene was in, for people like me, experimental artists, musicians and whatever, was Germany and Italy, where there were chances for people like Americans to do experimental work. So I really felt a rapport with Charles, and I loved the song so much. And I came home that night, and I thought, I need to write something. So I thought I will use that as a kind of map, that I will begin it the same way. And instead of Au Souverain, Sovereign, I would start with our superhero, Superman.
Oh, Superman.
That song today, it really is kind of eerie because it is the story of the collapse of a big corporate country. And that song in particular ends with a sequence of things. When love is gone, there's always justice. And when justice is gone, there's always force. And when force is gone, there's always a mom. Now, this is not the mom who's cooking cookies in your kitchen. This is the mom with petrochemical arms and electronic arms. This is the corporation, let's call it. And you realize, you know, they are not going to take care of you. And you look around and you go, yep, every man for himself. I play that song once every 10 years or something. When I hear it, I realize that it's very relevant to the moment, and in a really strange way. Also, I just got my second vaccine this morning. And they gave me a badge, a circular badge, with an arm being flexed on it. I thought, wait a second, that's a Superman cover. And is there something more big science than getting vaccinated? You know, big pharma, everything's big, and we're getting lost in here. So, you know, it's a really interesting moment.
Yeah. Didn't you play it in New York not long after 9/11?
I did, yep.
How was that?
That was eerie because, you know, there's lines in that song about here come the planes, they're American planes.
Mm.
This is the hound. The hand that takes. here come the planes. They're American planes, made in America. Smoking or non-smoking?
Chosen a beautiful piece of music by Brian Eno. That's on your list as well. When did you first meet Brian? Because you worked together on lots of musical projects, even very recently, and lots of artistic projects together. When did you first meet him?
Oh, gosh, I don't even remember that. I think in New York in the 70s. And he looked a lot different. He had really long hair. He was super glam. He had velvet outfits, and he was very... a very Fauntleroy kind of guy, but he had some really good ideas. I think he's such a brilliant person, and his music is some of the most adventurous stuff, and his visual things too. And it's all, in a funny way, coming from this same way of looking at the world that is so unique. And this song for me is a song that Lou Reed wrote, so Brian singing a Lou song is like, doesn't get better than that.
I've been set free, and I've been bound to the memories of yesterday's clouds. I've been set free and I've been bound and now I'm set free. I'm set free. I'm set free to find a new illusion. I've been
doing some research for this, and it, weirdly I do actually do some research. It might not sound like it.
It does sound like it. It does.
But I was listening to you speaking about doing interviews. This was an interview you were doing, and you were talking about this idea that kind of every conversation, especially ones like this, this is us kind of making a world, creating a different reality every time we talk about ourselves. Is that something, do you still feel like that?
Every time we talk about ourselves, I wonder what I possibly could have meant. I don't know. I mean, yes, I mean, I suppose that words do that. They're incredibly powerful. And so is the tone of voice, so that you can be looking at it, like right now I'm looking at this really beautiful blue sky. And if I just start talking about it in another way, you know, it gets less blue, so, and less beautiful. So, yes, language creates the world, I would have to say, and conversation gives it something to even push against. So it's an art form.
You've chosen Men of Good Fortune by Lou Reed, and I'm wondering if that was a song that was chosen because it does relate to recent political events. But then I thought, maybe it just relates to all political events that have occurred for a very long time. I'm not sure. Men of good fortune often cause empires to fall, while men of poor beginnings often can't do anything at all. As is now, as has always been thus, I feel, perhaps.
There have always been men of good fortune, and that is a kind of bit of an archaic way to talk about people, isn't it?
Mm.
Men of good fortune and men of poor beginnings. You know, it sounds like another century would refer to people like the, instead of the haves and the have-nots, or the one percenters, or whatever you're going to call them right now.
Yeah.
But it is a beautiful, poetic way to talk about what's innate and what you get, and how incredibly unfair the world is.
Men of good fortune often cause empires to fall, while men of poor beginnings often can't do anything at all. The rich son waits for his father to die. The poor just drink and cry. And me, I just don't care at all. Men of good fortune very often can't do a thing. While men of poor beginnings often can do anything. At heart they try to act like a man, handle things the best way they can. They have no rich daddy to fall back on. Men of good fortune often cause empires to fall, while men of poor beginnings often can't do anything at all. It takes money to make money, they say. Look at the Fords, but didn't they start that way? Anyway, makes no difference to me. Men of good fortune often wish they could die, while men of poor beginnings want what they have, and to get it they'll die. All those great things that life has to give, they want to have money and live. Don't care at all. Men of good fortune, men of poor beginnings.
The final piece of music, Avo Part.
Oh my gosh.
Why yeah. should we end with this song?
Because you don't know where it's going. You have no idea where this guy is going in this. And that's where we are. And I love music that does that to you.
Then that's the final song we should play. Laurie, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Same.
It's been lovely to speak to you. Take care. Be safe. That was a segment of Fratre for Eight Cellos by Avo Part, the final choice of my guest here on The First Time this week, Laurie Anderson. If you enjoyed the show, you can go to the BBC Sounds app and listen to previous shows from this series, including Paul Epworth and Corey Taylor from Slipknot, and search for archive programmes from people like St Vincent, Radiohead, Janelle Monáe, Dave Grohl and Debbie Harry. I'll be back next week when my guest will be Nitin Sawhney. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
Six Music.
This
is BBC Radio.
Six Music.
Right now, it's Loyal Kana.
There can never really be justice on stolen land. Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car is hooked up, no, you want to follow me. Your laws are minimal, because you won't even think about looking at the real criminal. This has got to cease, because we be getting hyped to the sound of the police. Now here's one little truth. Open your eye while you're checking out the boombox. Check out the exercise. Take the word overseer like a sample. Repeat it very quickly in a crew, for example. Overseer, 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 officer, 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 yeah, officer from overseer. You need a little clarity?